we start a series on meditation and the heart. This series only goes 6 classes, but it could be the entire year if we wanted it to be. And perhaps we'll bring it back again later on in the year because it's not going to be finished in 6 classes. And it's such an important topic, and also one in which oftentimes my topics have a kind of shake quite a bit. And to bring in a gentle topic like the meditation with heart, the heart of the meditation, the heart within meditation, can allow us to sort of settle into ourselves, which is important before the next shaking process unfolds. But I hope people appreciate the series, and I would encourage you to all pick up the homework between the Dana baskets, which hold the essence of the teaching for this week and each week, to integrate what is being said into our life. And I think this particular one is a good topic to do just that. And also the homework tonight is a good introduction of this topic into our life. But I'd like to start off with a quote from Joseph Campbell. He says, "All compassion, all caring is irrational. That's the point. Love is irrational. The rational is stressing the I-thou opposites. The mind is in the world of separateness and angular structures. Love puts the world together in a way that can't be calculated. Compassion, love, those jump mathematics," he says. So I appreciate that a lot, because it takes us, takes love, it takes the topic out of the range of thinking, doesn't it? It frees it up so that we can search for it, not through our mind searching, which is interesting. We try to do that with everything. But when we understand that the sense of me, the egoic sense of me, is built from our resistance to life, from our objections to it, from our argument with life, and when we understand that love is non-resistance to life, then we understand that the embodiment of me can never be loving, can never even be in touch with love, not in the way of the unconditioned love that we're speaking about. I mean, it can touch a breeze of it from time to time. But the embodiment of I, this egoic sense of I, then goes in search for it, because it feels like that's missing in his or her life. And sure enough, it is missing, because the very way we carry ourselves throughout life prohibits the complete emergence of that topic into our life. And so, and it's very interesting, you know, I'm writing this book, The Urban Buddhist, and I keep coming to these completely contradictions, complete contradictions in our practice, where we genuinely want something for our life, but we don't have any way of understanding how to get it. And so we go in search for it with the problem that embodies its absence. And this happens again and again and again in spiritual search. And this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. There's a hunger, especially in this age, for a caring heart, for caring, for genuine caring. And yet, the way we try to approach that caring is from the egoic sense of me wanting to be caring. And when I want to be caring, the sense of I is the inhibitor of an open heart. And so the it's really a death march that we're on. But we just think we aren't up to the tasks. We love to have some task that's impossible because we believe deeply in, if we just scratch the below the surface of our psychological makeup, each of us think that the spiritual fulfillment is really impossible for us. So when we pursue something that's impossible, it kind of gives us credit for at least trying. And love is one of those things. It's really like searching for air. Or a fish looking for water. The way the mind organizes itself in relationship to life, it can't see it. Because the way it organizes itself, and I love the way Joseph Campbell talks about it, in terms of the I, thou opposites, the tension of that particular perspective is the absence of love. And we keep looking for it from a certain disposition towards it, like what it felt like when the first days of a romantic relationship. We think that's love. Now, where is that? Universally. We go and search with from our ideas about what we think it is, which is more of the confusion of our whole way of seeing. And we pass it by. We swim through it. We breathe it. It's in the capillaries of our blood system. But we're so used to thinking of it as other than what is that we keep searching for what isn't. And it confounds us because we're looking for a particular expression of it. We're looking for a particular way of what our idea of what love is. You know, one of the I appreciate so much the four Brahma Viharas. We've done talks on the four Brahma Viharas, the different depictions of love. When it's different aspects of love come forward from different when it's connecting to different aspects of life, like in pain, the aspect of love that arises is compassion. These are all just aspects of metta, pure love. When somebody has succeeded, the aspect of love that embraces the success in another person is mudita, joy for another person's success. And when there is just the meeting of connectedness, the warm-heartedness, we call that metta. That's an aspect of love, is that warm-hearted tenderness. But it doesn't mean that if those particular forms and expressions that bring forth compassion or mudita or karuna are missing, that love is missing. It's not. Other ways that it forms, when it meets poverty, the expression of love when it interfaces with poverty or lacking is generosity. When it meets irritation or restlessness, that aspect that arises in oneself and towards others is patience. You see, it has many faces. When it meets the confusing aspects of life, it opens to wonder and the mystery. it doesn't always feel tender and warm. And it can say no as quickly and as easily as it can say yes. It doesn't have a smiling face. It's not have a good day face. It doesn't have a configuration that is identifiable. Except that in all of its different expressions, it brings things together. And it never works to separate in distance. And you can think of any aspect of what I've already said, and that whatever forms or activities that love takes, ultimately it nourishes that sense of interconnectedness between. But it doesn't feel like love as we know it, with this kind of tender sweetness. I mean, that's one expression of it. But if those circumstances and stimuli are altered, it alters according to whatever is the next thing it needs. It's the next expression in that meeting. So the reason why is that we look for it in one particular way. We think, oh, it has to do with some kind of tender-heartedness, longing for, or something. Like what we think of when we think of romantic love. But romantic love is the mind, because love can't be denied even by the mental fabric of the mind, although it certainly tries desperately to eliminate it as much as it can. Because why does it try to do that? Because it's whimsical. It doesn't feel controllable to the mind, so the mind just moves on to the rational. The rational, I can think about things and I can predict things from logic, from mathematics, but I can't predict things from love. And because it's unpredictable, it wants to move over, get over love. It thinks of it as being sort of cute and nice, but irrelevant, really, to life. In fact, you can look at our medical field. In times of plenty, positions like social workers and chaplains get funded. But when the money gets scarce, they're the ones that are the first salaries to go, because what do they really do anyway? Right? But by God, the nurse who gives the pill on time is still paid, because that's what we call healing, is the functionality. And the rest of it is, well, if we have good times, then we can have good time. We can let this other thing that's completely unpredictable and unreliable and not controllable. Although it is testable, which is very interesting. You see, love is testable. In fact, they have shown that people with certain types of cancer do as well from support groups only as other types of that same type of cancer does with chemotherapy without support groups. So that sense of being connected and talking and sharing and being vulnerable and open has as much to do with healing as the chemotherapy product has to do with healing in certain types of cancers. And they've also shown that you can take patients on the West Coast that are unknown by people on the East Coast and have the people on the East Coast send them metta or prayer, and that just by showing them a picture of who it is that they're praying for or sending metta to, and that this has that group over a control group that didn't have those prayers sent those ways will heal quicker. Now, we don't like that, you see, because it doesn't, the A equals B, it breaks down there. And when things get fuzzy, we just rule them out. The mind can't figure it out, so it bypasses it and says, well, it must be it's a failed experience or something, experiment. And so we, We get frightened by that. Love frightens us. We have to understand, I think, that. And because that, you see, when we work in terms of our meditation, love is the last strategy that we'll try in our meditation, because it's, we don't even know what it is, really. How do you bring forth love in meditation? So we'll try to do things which mentally have worked for us in the past. We'll try to become more defensive, more resistant to something, to sort of outlast it, or we'll wait it out, or we'll do lots of kind of mental gymnastics to end a particular difficult mind state, except allow it. Allowance is the last step that we'll try. Because what protection do I have in allowance? It's like opening the gate and anything can come in. And I'm not going to do that. You see, because from the mind's point of view, from the way the mind works, which is the I-thou opposites, I have to stay protected. I have to keep something in reserve in case an open gate doesn't work. What am I going to do if I get stampeded here? And so the last thing we'll try, but the definition of love is allowance. The definition of love is non-resistance. And so we get in our meditation and we try to, and we can't feel it. We can't feel its power. We don't sense its capacity to really do the work that we need to get done. We sense it in our muscles. We sense it in the tension. We sense it in our defensiveness. But we don't sense it in letting things be. Allowing them to be what they are. Opening to them. Just seeing. Awareness. Which is love. Which is a synonym for love. That's the last thing we trust. And so if we really look at our practice and if we're honest, you know, most of us resign kind of a resignation of having to put up with a state of mind, but not real acceptance of that state of mind, where there's no inhibition towards it whatsoever. And so we back our way into love, you see, because all the other strategies just continue the tension, the inevitable lifetime tension with something. And that gets very tiring, doesn't it? To continually fight, have an inward fighting, an inward tension with ourselves. And so it's like we're going back and back on a boat, and suddenly we fall off the boat into the water. A friend of mine, Larry Rosenberg, tells the story of when his mother was dying. He was by her bedside. This was told to me secondhand, so it may not be exactly right. But he was holding her hand, and he was trying to be the meditation teacher for his dying mother. So he was saying, "Let go, mother, just let go into the unknown." And every time he would say that, the grip of his mother would get tighter. And finally, he says, "Mother, I love you," and the grip softens and she dies. You see, one was from the mental display, the mental, okay, mom, this is how you do it, this is how you work it. The mind's calculated response, probably thought out before it even went. But in the moment, what was the way that his mother could really surrender was to release in love. I have two nursing friends, and this is some years ago, but they were going through nursing school at the time, and one was a very precise and her documentation and doing all of the procedures of what a nurse is supposed to do, and she scheduled them and she did it right, and she was just, you know, everything was like ship shape. And the other nurse was documented late and had to stay late and got the pill. You know, the pill wasn't necessarily delivered right on the hour. But she had this wonderful heart and would spend time with the patients, and the patients loved her. But the second nurse was telling me and comparing herself to the first nurse, and she says, you know, I'll just never be the good quality nurse that Nancy is. And I said, you know, Evelyn, if I were in bed, sick, there's no question which one I would like to have tend me to health. Is there, really? In fact, I remember as a young boy, I think I was 12, I was having my appendix out, and I would wait all day for a particular nurse to show up because it was the one person who showed, who developed a relationship, who had time. And I have no idea whether she was thought of as a good nurse by the supervisors, but I know I thought of her. In fact, I still remember the feeling I had on her day off. And this is 50 years later. Isn't that amazing? I don't remember what she looked like, but I remember the quality of her contact. That's the power of this thing. And it's not mentally controllable. That's the thing. It's not something that we can get our arms around. But we try, because the mind in its fixed response to life, tries to make monuments from love. It writes poetry, and then the poetry is its semblance of love. It's its representation of love. Or sing songs, the songs we hear. 90% of songs are about love. They're trying to make some proclamation out of it, something that we can have as a representation for, or a monument, or a piece of art. And but the sense of love, if we just release the tension of me, the tension within me, if we relax the tension of self, this sense of something else coming in, besides, after our defenses have dropped, and you can feel it, you know, the resistance has a certain kind of containment or a contracted quality to it, where I'm back here and kind of back behind my defense patterns and the world is out there. In some way, we begin to trust sufficiently where we begin to relax some of that. Just soften the tensions of the mind. And suddenly this thing opens up and we're in a different medium. A different medium. There's still air to breathe. But there's if it's a different medium. And we begin, oh. So this is what it is. And it's not particularly comfortable to be seen by the mind, because the mind doesn't honor sensitivity. And that's the way this thing goes. It moves towards sensitivity and towards a kind of vulnerability. Feels as if it means that you could easily be attacked or threatened. But what I mean is a kind of a rawness of being. And that is the perfect configuration, psychic configuration, for the acknowledgement of what's always at hand. For the fish seeing water. For the human seeing air. So we can't grab it. It's not something that we can, as much as I would love to suggest it, it's not really we can't really practice love. What we can do is incline our mind towards it through intentionality. And just the intentionality, when we hear the qualities of what love is, we say, oh, you know, I want that. I want to abide in love. I want to know that. And the sense of self tries to set itself up for that march, and very quickly it fails. And so because the need or the inclination is genuine, sincere, which is a attribute of love, we begin to use love to seek itself. We don't use the mind to seek love, we use love to seek love. So how is it that we meet the objections that we have in life? We meet them with the meditation and the instructions of the meditation. Relax, observe, and allow. Just let things be. Those are an attempt to offer love to the resistances of life in order to find love once the resistances have dropped. So the means of what we do to seek love is the ends that we seek in finding love. So we can't use hardness of heart or tension or struggle in order to become loving. It doesn't make any sense anyway. And so we start, okay, I'm going to incline my mind towards kindness, towards love, towards sensitivity. And we'll see what happens. And we won't even know sometimes how accessible it is or that it's working. I worked with a social worker, when I first started hospice, who was my mentor, and she was really a brilliant social worker. And she would go out into the homes, and she had many, many things that she could offer the dying patient. She could offer guided meditations and imagery and relaxation techniques and journaling. And I mean, she really had many, many tasks that she could have the dying patient do. So she had this one African-American man, and he lived a long time under our care, and she just offered him the whole array of all the different strategies that she had for the different problems that he had. And he had gone through all of that months later, and on his deathbed, when he only had a little bit of time left, she visited and she said to him, you know, I've offered you all of these different exercises. What has been the most helpful? It would be very helpful to me to know which one has been the most helpful so that I can encourage that with others. And he said, what was most helpful was that I knew you cared. And that threw her back into a whole different thing. Because her sincerity, I mean, there was no question, her sincerity was an expression of her heart. She really did care. And that's what the patient felt. Not the exercises that he had to do. He did those, quite likely, just so that he would have more of the caring from her. So behind the scenes, us therapists, doctors, technicians, behind the scenes, in those brief moments of interaction, you see, your job, our jobs, have as much to do with those brief moments of interaction as they do with the mechanical tasks at hand. And yet, we don't perceive that at all, because the mind never will. The mind is a calculating machine. It wants to know how much you got done today. And can you prove it? Show me. So why does love seem so inaccessible to us? Why does it seem so remote, so distant? Well, part of it is that we don't really trust it, as I was mentioning. Most of us have histories of relationships that have soured. We have felt mistrusting in them. We've been hurt. Somewhere throughout our life, we have a fear of intimacy. Many, many of us, perhaps most of us, have a fear of intimacy, of letting someone else come close to us psychically so that we can be known. We have a culture that is not very ethical, and so rightly so, we are guarded in what we think the other person wants from us. And all of this has made a kind of brittleness to our psyche. And this fear of being hurt, and this sense of mistrust from a variety of different reasons, we bring forth in relationships. And we bring forth in our work. And so we never settle, we never really relax with ourselves sufficiently to allow the great healer of love to come forth. We keep it tucked in. We keep it behind a barricade. And that sense of vulnerability is not something that is honored in this culture. In fact, I remember after I think maybe it was high school or early in college, I had a girlfriend who we broke up, and I said, okay, that's it. I'm never going to feel again. I'm going to be a rock. And at that particular time, Simon and Garfunkel had this song, I'm a Rock. And so I sang it all the time to myself. And I just led with that intentionality. Okay, I'm going to be an island. I'm unfeeling. Can't be hurt. And I really got into it. You know, and so you just can go in any direction you want to with this thing. And if we're driven by pain, we can become rocks. Except the problem is that it's more painful than the vulnerability. An unfeeling person, uncaring, as when you see one of a person such, you can feel it because they've been hurt. You know, you've been. I had a friend. I'm in story land, so you have to forgive me. I had a friend who was like me. He said, "You know, Rodney, I've never felt love." So that's interesting. And then a friend, he was going away and asked this man to take care of his cat. And so during the week or 2 weeks that the man was gone and he left his cat with this other person, at one point, my friend was saying that he just reached down and pet the cat. And he felt this warmth of heart. And he said, that must be love. And so as the story goes, he bought a cat. I don't care where we start. A cat's fine. A cat's fine. In fact, there's the unconditionality of the receptivity of pets provides a vulnerability. You see, we look for ways that we can open our heart, and usually around pets we can do that. Or around children, small children, like the one in the back. Or somebody who's very ill and can't defend, and undefended. Right? Then we can, like with the dying, I could show up for the dying because what could they do? Right? You see? But it doesn't matter where we start, because the feeling of intimacy grows. It nurtures itself. You want to take it through the dying, through the animal, through the young, and find access. I says, if this is possible with this, why isn't it possible with this? And there's this encouragement because it's contagious. And we like ourselves in that. Suddenly, for once in our life, we're likable. Not only in the receptivity the other person gives us, but in the qualities come forth that arise in those occasions. And then we go out and get back on our job and get solely again and we close ourselves off. But we remember. There's this thing that we remember. Oh yes, I remember. Sometimes we have to look decades to find it. But there is a moment when we remember. Because you see, love is a certain faith is required. Even in our worst disposition, our worst moments, our worst attitudes, if our inclination, if we're inclining ourselves in that direction, meaning if we have taken an intention towards that, we'll stop and we'll say, where is there love in this moment? Where is love in this moment? Because you'll miss it. You'll want to find it not in some abstract time or with only children or only cats or only dying patients, but now. Where is love now? And those of us who have been doing this for a while knows we cannot find love or search for it outside of the context of the here and now. So let's just shut those doors. Well, I'm not ready for it, or I can't. It must be somewhere in the future, or I'm just not loving enough. No, nonsense. It's here, or it's nowhere. Where is her love now? And immediately, the orientation, a whole different orientation comes into the moment. Or is there love for this too? No matter what we're feeling, how irritable, how annoyed, is there love for this too? Or is it selective, polarizing, the I and thou opposites? Calculating, mathematical, how much more time have I got to be irritable before I can get to? Is that the way we approach love? Or is there love for this too? As soon as we say, is there love for this too, our disposition is towards receiving what is seeming to block love. And so we're meeting that which seems to block love with love. Nothing can withstand that force of allowance. Nothing. And love becomes the medium through which we work. Fish recognizing water. And loving it, appreciating the fact that it floats. That, see, that takes faith. It doesn't, we're not going to see it. It's not going to be observable in the normal way our mind looks for it. But it has an intuitive, physiological, intuitive sensing of it. In much the same way as a child must sense being held by his or her mother, the safety of that is communicated. Just the ability to relax. I remember sitting on my grandfather's knee when I was a very young boy, probably was less than five, and never feeling safer in my life. See, wow, this, like just loving that moment. There's another moment in which I was completely safe within that expression that was coming from him. And that sense of safety is resonant to love itself. If we're looking for safety in order to be loving, it's the cart before the horse. The sense of safety comes from love. We have to meet our objections, our mistrust, with a risk, with a vulnerability, in order to find the safety that we're looking for prior to opening to love. This sense of relaxation and ease. The willingness, because love's not asking anything. You see, it's not a bargaining chip. I'll be loving if. There's no condition to it. It's taking me exactly the way I am and holding that as being perfectly okay. And if you've ever had someone offer you unconditional love, like a pet, it doesn't matter if you're in a bad mood, doesn't matter if you're irritable, doesn't matter if you had a bad day and you're... There it is. Unconditionally. That is what we're bringing to ourselves in the meditation. We can't look for it externally. It's great if we find it in brief moments with our grandfather or some nurse when I have my appendix out. But in general, it's not going to meet us around every corner. But something else can, internally. We can induce that state. Induction is the wrong word. We can release ourselves into that state through our own means. And find the world is full of just that unconditionality. Always there's space. Space without reprimand, without judgment. Giving complete permission to be anything we want to be. And so we'll risk, and only through love would we ever risk, being different than our habits tell us we need to be. The only way to ever break out of habit and to risk something and expose something that we don't even know what's going to come out, spontaneity, is through love. There's no other way. It's the key, the door, the lock, the chamber. Everything we need. Is there love for this too? No matter what arises, is there love for this too? Just to incline our minds in that direction. Instilling our heart into our practice. Not becoming a rock from our practice, which you can do. Not becoming insulated from life, distant and remote, claiming that to be the equanimous state. Love is the equanimous state. Because there's no reactivity. And from there, everything can move through it. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute? So as we're sitting, how are we sitting? Is there love for whatever arises right now? Is there love for this too? On the homework, I offer that phrase, is there love for this too, to carry with you, to incline your mind. And the further you incline your mind down the path of that intentionality, the more empty will become. All it requires is an inclination. Because we'll see that the absence of love is the presence of me. And because the heart thrives within that medium, it will easily, it's not even a question, it will release the tension of the me to find that medium, to rediscover itself. Is there love for this too? Okay. Any questions or comments? We have a little bit of time before announcements. Yes. Yes. Yes, dear. Love and compassion, as I mentioned early in the talk, there's two different words because it's two expressions of love. Love in the face of pain is compassion. Okay? Love in the face of someone else's joy is mudita. Okay? Actually, even upeka or equanimity is love in the face of just life itself. Because it's not reactive, it's just, we think of equanimity as a kind of a distancing, or I don't know, sort of a neutrality, a mental neutrality, which it is not. I don't even use that word. I don't use that word because however I talk about it, it's misunderstood. It's full aliveness, embodying and abiding within life. And because there's the lack of resistance to life, there's no objection to what's happening. And that non-objective, on that non-resistance, in the non-argument, that's equanimity. And that's also love. You see? So I really encourage us to think of equanimity as abiding in love, rather than as some protective, insulated chamber that the mind can find, because it can't. It can find the mental proximity of any of the Brahma-viharas. And the mental proximity is off. It's just a couple of clicks off. But it feels good, or feels like a relief to the problems of our life. And so we keep festering or fostering and encouraging a deeper cave within ourselves, rather than what it really means is a full expression of ourselves. Other questions or comments? Yes. Yes. Allowance. Yes.
And that works a lot for me, especially when I think, sometimes, you know, I can get so upset at myself if I'm not acting the way that I
right.
like, or if I'm
right.
not feeling the way that I
right.
like. Once in a while, I've been able to get back into this sense of, no, wait a second, it's okay to be upset or irritable.
Yes.
Or
yes, yes. The question is around the sense of acceptance as being a quality of love. We have to be careful what we mean by acceptance, because the continuum seems to suggest that what you accept on the same continuum, you'll reject at another time. But that continuum, right? But allowance has a broader expanse. It doesn't have an opposite, or you could say disallowance, but allowance is just letting be, letting things be as they are. Now, here's what I suggest when you're embroiled in all of that judgment. You're not going to find the qualities of love by countering your argument of judgment with a, offsetting your judgment with a counter argument. It's like, I'm judging now, but I'm going to accept that judgment. You can't do it mentally. You can't play ping pong in there and come up with love. So you go to the air around, that surrounds you and see what the air is thinking about what you're doing. And it's not doing anything. It's just holding you. It's just embracing you. So all of this is going on internally, and I'm trying to figure out how my way to love. Meanwhile, I'm being held by the air. Feel, let yourself feel being held by the air. Do you see? It's, you're taking yourself, your frame of reference out of your mind, which I have, you have to do. You can't mentalize the way, the journey through finding a counter alternative to what it is that you're feeling, which is the way we usually do it. We try to do it through a mental frame of reference. We need a different reference point entirely. And then you can just dance. Be irritable and just dance in the air. And the air holds all of your antics. It holds all of your emotion. It holds all of your activity. And there it is. And then you can begin to get this sense of frames of reference. Because awareness is more like the air, and that's more what I mean by allowance than an accepting what it is that's going on. When really part of us, ourselves, doesn't accept what's going on, and we never will, and we can get caught in that. How now? I've got to work on the part that's not accepting, and really we're dividing the mind unacceptingly, pitting one part of the mind against itself, and it's in this constant state of argument. Where the larger part is trying to, would I don't know, trying to win the argument. Recast it. Recast it. Feel it now. Feel it now. Let the, feel whatever you're feeling, whatever you're thinking, let just cast it outside. Cast a wider embrace than that. You see, it doesn't matter. This love. And all of a sudden, this whole thing is being held in a completely different way. You get a sense? Is there love for this too? You can make that a mental argument, or you can embrace, make it a much more embracing. Is there love for this too? Because love doesn't do anything to it. All it does is reveal. That's all it does. It's like a light. All it does is, oh, you're acting like a nerd, okay? You're acting like a jerk. You're acting like a loving person. You're acting like a selfish person. It doesn't try to change anything. It just lights it all up. And we work our way, that gets worked out. The knot of all the resistance and the mistrust and the willful force, all of that works itself out through the light, through the observation, through the ability of love just to see. It all gets worked out, not through our own energetic will, but through the intention of our heart to want to be free in love. Intention does it all. We just get in our way. And the quicker we understand that we get in our way, the quicker we'll let love in. That's the equation of it all. So, question, yes?
Why is it that we look for safety first and love second from another person?
We look for what?
We,
safety.
Can we get backwards?
Right. Right. So why do we look for safety first and love second? It doesn't work out, does it? Yeah. I just think because of our scar tissue that we all carry, that we perceive that we can only trust in when the person or situation is trustworthy. And so anything that we perceive as untrustworthy, we refuse to let down our guard. But the fact is that we can trust all things, whether they're trustworthy or not. You see, when you realize that you can't be hurt, then what is there to fear? You see? But we are timid in that direction, to say the least, and we still believe we can get hurt. So what we mean by getting hurt is that we get have an emotion, to, you know, an emotion of inadequacy, or some of the deepest, most ingrained beliefs and assumptions in ourselves get activated. The deepest, darkest ones get activated. They're in us, but somebody who can manipulate us has access to those places in us that we don't trust in ourselves, like our feelings of inadequacy. And to protect ourselves, we repress those areas and keep the other person at bay. But when you really have it lined up so that it doesn't, so that these things are things that you want to see, because when they're hidden, they destroy us. But when we can see them, then we have a chance to be alive within them and to heal from them. So then, whether somebody's mistrusting, meaning they can hurt, or seeming intentional to hurt me, well, that's okay. I mean, they're not going to be my best friend. I mean, there's love seeks its own kind. You aren't going to hang out with gangsters. But if you meet a gangster, it's okay. You say, okay. You know, there's not this whole sense of protection that needs to arise. Now, that's very hard and not easily accessed in the most experienced meditator. But it's a way of working. What is it that you can't feel in yourself? What's so awful? What would come up? What could somebody do on the outside of physically harming you, which of course you don't want any part of? Where are you susceptible to hurt? See, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Because I want to know that. Because that's where I'm closed off and mistrusting to life. And anything that resonates with that, I'm protected. I'm self-protected. But I want to know that. And then fewer and fewer areas of ourself need that kind of contraction. Okay, no. Okay, well, one more question. Yes, Susan.
Before I came tonight, I got some bad news about a loved one. And I received the news with a great sense of calmness and acceptance. And then later I was a little surprised by that and wondered if it was my mind, which I sometimes don't trust, protecting me or kind of a steeliness. And I'm just curious about how you sort of sort that out.
Later, did the emotions arise?
Yeah.
Yes. And so this woman is saying that she received some bad news about a loved one, and her first response to that was kind of a, what?
I felt at peace.
At peace with it. Okay. So it wasn't disturbing, right? But then after a while, the emotion started coming as you weighed in on what that would mean to your life, quite likely, as the story came back in. I wouldn't mistrust any of that. I think it's all, I don't think there's any of that is mistrusting. I think we can hold even traumatic incidences differently as we practice, but it doesn't mean that our mind doesn't catch hold and embroil it into the story of how we'll miss that person or what it'll mean to my life, in which case the grief emotions and some of the reactivity comes through and the sadnesses and all. And all of that's part of the learning as well. So we're not trying to protect ourselves from the backlash of that thought, but neither are we distrusting that initial response of the acceptance of the allowance of the information as it's received. So I think the whole thing is just the way it was. Okay, good.